And when I'm really tired, I kind of walk about with one eye open. And I was like kind of wandering about the house with one eye open for 10 minutes, trying to get to work. And as I kind of had my shower and had breakfast and had my coffee, things started becoming a little bit clearer. I had both eyes open and I could kind of see what was happening. I was about to dash out to work and I thought, wait a minute, you better put your glasses on, Brian. So I put my glasses on and the strangest thing happened, which has happened now. Instead of becoming clearer, everything went a little bit blurry. And then I realized I already had my contact lenses in, about like I do today. My kind of vision enhancers were already on my eyes. So when I added my second set, instead of making things sharp and clear, it just made them blurry and out of focus. And I wonder if you've had the same experience with Daniel chapter 8, where you've read it maybe countless times, maybe just this morning, you think, ooh. And the first time you read the chapter, or the second or third, you kind of stumble about, one eye open, not entirely sure what's going on. Charging rams and furious goats with their odd horn growth are kind of taking over Daniel. And after that, if you consider the passage, it can become a little bit clearer, can't it? But the danger is you can put an extra lens on some passages like Daniel 8. You try and either view the chapter through the lens of the previous chapter, or you view it through what someone else has told you, or you view it through just the past, or you view it through just the future. And what could have been a clear message suddenly becomes a little bit blurry. And that's probably the fear that most of us have when we come to the second half of Daniel. I think Steve touched on it last week, and it's the fear I have when we come to the second half of Daniel. Although me and Steve managed to be able to do the sermons for most of them. But this morning I want us to come to Daniel 8 afresh. Just try and forget what was in the past or what the lens you might put on. And just come to it with fresh eyes. What's happening? Who's involved? What does it tell us about God? How do we apply it to our own lives? So as we look through today's passage, I'm going to try and outline it under three main headings. Three is always a good number, isn't it, when it comes to church talks? Kingdoms already been, kingdoms that are, and the kingdom still to come. And as I write the heading, kingdoms already been, you might see a flaw in my plan if you're awake this morning. As Daniel's having his vision, it's not about a kingdom that's already been. It's about a kingdom that's still to come. But as we are talking about it, it's not about a kingdom still to come, it's about a kingdom that's already been. Are you with me? There was a few faces like that when I said that today. But what Daniel reminds us of is that when visions are given in the Bible, they don't always just have a one-time only fulfillment. Yeah, they can have a very specific fulfillment and a specific event, but they can point to something else as well. The fulfillment can be shown often multiple times through the course of history. So what's Daniel's vision all about? Well, note when the vision's given. Verse 1 in the chapter tells us it's in the third year of King Belshazzar's, or Belshazzar's. I think when I did that chapter, I called him multiple names. We'll call him King B. Now this is the same Belshazzar who we encountered in Daniel chapter 5. So in the midst of the rule and the authority of this powerful king, Daniel has a vision about what's to come. And don't be put off by the talk of rams and goats. It's not some weird language or ancient custom. It's actually something we quite often do today. We attribute an animal to a country. You've got the English lion, the British bulldog, the American eagle. You've even got the Scottish unicorn. Yes, that is our national animal. So we don't have to get this huge cultural leap to figure out that actually what the ram and the goat represent is countries and kingdoms. And one of the great things about this chapter, Daniel doesn't just talk about rams and goats and a large horn splitting into four, and then just leave us to it. He actually goes on to explain a little bit too. Not always in the detail we'd like, but he does give us some detail in it. The vision and its initial fulfillment. Oh, I hope you can read that, because I can't from here. The two-horned ram is the empire of the Medes and the Persians. The one-horned goat we learn about, well, that's Alexander the Great. The four horns, well, that's four generals who divided Alexander's empire between them. You get a history lesson to do as well. Today is great. And the little horn, well, that was a ruler that came out of one of the four rulers that took over Alexander's kingdom. So what Daniel saw in his vision actually came to fulfillment in ancient times. And remember when the vision was given, Belshazzar was in power. And who took over from Belshazzar? Well, the last two verses of Daniel chapter 5 tell us this. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom. The Mede and Persian Empire, the ram with two horns, took over. And it was seemingly all-powerful and all-conquering. But then Alexander the Great came along. The goat, he's the goat with the prominent horn. And he comes and takes all before him. The seemingly unconquerable empire of the Persians and Medes has suddenly been conquered. But Alexander's rule, even though it was vast and all-powerful at the time, it doesn't last either. He dies and four generals take over. They're the four horns that came from the one prominent horn. And the progress in the book of Daniel seems rapid, doesn't it? Eight verses from the reign of King Belshazzar to the end of Alexander the Great. But in real time, the progress wasn't quite so quick. Daniel's vision depicts this turbulent and extended period of time in history. So you think, well, why bother putting it in the Bible if it's just about history? Well, two things for us to remember today, among many. Earthly kingdoms are finite. It doesn't seem like they'll be never-ending in the midst of an unassailable power. Your average Persian wouldn't have imagined that the Greek Empire would overrun it. Your average Greek probably wouldn't have imagined that the Roman Empire would overrun it. But it happened. And when you look back through history, you see once powerful, all-conquering empires, and where are they? They're not here anymore. Once powerful, then replaced. Then powerful, then replaced. So earthly kingdoms are finite, and I think that's really important for us to remember today. Step two. As Christians, we are called to durable, faithful Christian living. I've signed up to do a marathon next year. I'd love to be able just to turn up on April the 7th and run 26.2 miles. But I know that's not going to happen. So ahead of me, I have to endure a winter of training. Early starts. Freezing cold winds, probably. As a church, we are called to live faithfully through whatever history throws at us. Today in 21st century Carlisle, 21st century UK, the biggest collective issue that we'll be dealing with is Brexit. There was a big march in London yesterday, wasn't there, about Brexit? It's everywhere. And you might be dreading Brexit this morning, or you might be looking forward to it. Your biggest fear might be no deal, or it might be a Chequers deal. You might want a soft Brexit, or you might want a hard Brexit. Or you might just wish it was all over. Whatever your view, however you feel, as a Christian individually, and I think particularly as a church collectively, we are called to trust God through times like this, through the bumps and the lumps of history. We're called to follow God, just like Daniel did. Earthly kingdoms are finite. God's kingdom is forever. But there is one part of the vision that I haven't touched on yet, and that's the little horn that was mentioned in verses 9 to 12 and 23 to 25. And while this part of the vision did have its fulfillment in the past, I want us to consider it under the next heading, which is the kingdoms that are. Verse 9 says this, out of one of them, that's the four horns, came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. This focuses on one of the empires that came from Alexander the Great. But why does Daniel focus on this one empire? Why does God use Daniel in this one empire? And what do we learn from it today? Well, the verses 8 to 12 and 23 to 25 refer to an individual called Antiochus the Fourth. I think I've said that right. When Alexander's kingdom was split into four, one of the generals was a man called Seleucus, and then from him, from that particular line, came this fella called Antiochus. Now, this guy had a bit of an ego, because he took the name Epiphanes, signifying that he considered himself as a god. He thought he was some kind of divine power. And long after Daniel's vision, hundreds of years after Daniel was alive, Antiochus terrorized God's people. One commentator said this. He said he became, for God's people, the very embodiment of blasphemous evil and the cause of enormous and prolonged suffering and oppression. Antiochus was responsible for destruction, for abuse, for murder, and the desecration of holy places. This man set himself up against God and his people. And he did three big things. Verses 10 and 11 tells us that he sinned against God. Verse 24 tells us he sinned against God's people. And verse 12 and verse 25 tell us he sinned against God's truth. The man represented by the small horn was a tangible, invisible form of evil. But I've given this kind of title, kingdoms that are, not kingdoms that were, because Antiochus isn't with us anymore. So while this fellow is the single historical character in view, the primary kind of fulfillment of Daniel's vision, there's no doubt that he provides an archetype, he provides a model. He represents a reality that's been seen at different times in history. Anti-God, anti-church, anti-truth. That's the forces that the people of God of the Old Testament faced. And it's the forces that the Christian church face today. Graham's video illustrated that this morning. A quick look on a website tells us what happens to Christians around the world. I think your video was Open Doors USA. And I looked on Open Doors this week. As an organization that supports persecuted Christians around the world, and they do a great job. But like 10 minutes on the Open Doors website tells you this. I found out about Sujit, a church leader in rural India, who'd had seen his church destroyed 3 times. And when the 3rd time, when he tried to stop the people destroying his church building, they beat him as well and hit him with a brick. In North Korea, they think there's between 50,000 and 70,000 Christians been held in labor camps just because they believe in Jesus. And we found out about Helen this morning, didn't we? 2 years in a container just because she trusted Christ. There's more extreme examples, and they're harrowing, aren't they? But you might find this morning they don't directly relate to you. You've not been held in a container and you've not been beaten up for stopping someone wrecking a church building. But we do see less violent but more subtle ways of hostility towards God and his people and the truth Christians believe. Lies and deception about who God is and what Christians are. Have you ever had the conversation when someone asks you, doesn't God hate? Fill in the blank yourself. If you've been in Scotland recently, you might have seen a poster like this. It says, dear bigots, division seems to be what you believe in. We don't want your religious hate on our buses, on our streets and in our communities. We don't want you spreading your intolerance or making people's lives a misery. You may not have faith and respect and love, but we do. That's why if we see you or hear your hate, we're reporting you. End of sermon. Signed off by Yours, Scotland. Poster's part of a series that's been produced by the Scottish Government and the police in Scotland. And it also addresses transphobia and homophobia and racism. And in one sense, they're good If they highlight areas where people are subject to abuse or have violence committed against them or are given derogatory remarks against them, then as a Christian, we must support that because we don't want that to happen to anyone. But the problem is the posters are a bit ambiguous too. And as such, they're open to manipulation. If I express a biblically based view in something like marriage, but someone disagrees, am I guilty of a hate crime? At what point will I be unable to legally express my Christian views? Doesn't matter how lovingly or graciously or gently I express them. We do live in a world where God, his people, and his truth are attacked. Sometimes violently, sometimes subtly, but it's still done. But we shouldn't be surprised. I like to go running. And one of the unexpected side effects, one of the benefits of running, is that I get to scare people. It's really good. I don't like chase people down the street. Like Halloween, I suddenly change my running outfit. And I don't like hide behind trees and jump out on them. But people do get scared when I run. And there's always two categories of people in particular. Loved up couples, walking along, gazing adoringly into each other's eyes. And dog owners and their pets, walking along, gazing adoringly into each other's eyes. I'll be on a path running along. And from a distance, I'll see them. They'll be on the same path, maybe ahead, and I'm running towards them. So I'll shout, "Excuse me." And as I get closer, I'll be shouting, "Excuse me." And I'll keep saying, "Excuse me, excuse me." And then usually when I'm right behind them, they notice I'm there. And they turn around and look like that. What do the groups have in common? Well, they're all surprised and shocked when I run right up behind them because for some reason, they'd not heard or sensed me approaching. And one of the great things about God, one of the great things about the Bible, is that he gives us the equivalent of "excuse me" for us. He says passages such as the one today, they're not there to unnecessarily worry or scare us. They're there to prepare us. Don't be surprised when you're persecuted. Don't be surprised when you're lied about. Don't be shocked when truth is thrown down. It's going to happen. Be prepared. That's what God tells us. Jesus extends the same kindness to us. In John 15, he says this, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world." That's why the world hates you. Remember what I told you. A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, Jesus says, they'll persecute you also. Daniel and Jesus tell the church, you will be persecuted. You'll be given a hard time because of your faith. Don't be surprised. And the question you'll scream out is why? Why hatred towards you, God? Why do people want to persecute me because of my faith in you? Why do people reject you and your truth? And it's a valid question. It's just not one that Daniel chapter 8 answers. Instead, we have the question, how long? And that brings us into our last section, the kingdom still to come. In verses 9 to 12, we had the description of the leader, didn't we? Who was opposing God. And in verses 13 and 14, we have the conversation between two holy beings. And it says this, "Then I heard the Holy One speaking, and another Holy One said to him, 'How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled, the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people?' He said to me, 'It'll take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated.'" How long is the question? 2,300 mornings and evenings is the answer. In the book of Exodus, it tells us this. Says this is what you are to offer on the altar regularly each day. 2 lambs a year old, offer one in the morning and the other at twilight, at the time of Daniel's vision, at the time of Antiochus's persecution. People are instructed to offer a sacrifice twice a day. So what does 2,300 mornings and evenings mean? Is it 2,300 separate sacrifices, meaning 1,150 days? Or is it actually 2,300 days? I'm not going to give you an answer. Because depending on what book you read, you could be equally convinced of either argument. But then you get really confused. And this is where you could get caught up sometimes in the book of Daniel. This is where you could put the glasses on. And what's kind of clear actually becomes really blurry, and you miss the point of what Daniel's trying to say. A commentator called Dale Ralph Davis puts it well. He says, the 2,300 figure tells us it's rather a long period, but the fact that it's calculated means that it's definitely a limited one. The main point is, the trampling of God's people won't last forever. The reign of the little horn, the fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue, it's not going to go on forever. In fact, every time God's people are persecuted, even though the suffering's great, the end will come. Why? Because when the church is persecuted, it's not just the people of God that the persecutors are setting themselves up against. It's God himself. Verses 11 and 25 say this. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. And it says in 25, he will take his stand against the Prince of Princes. In my previous youth work role, sometimes things got a bit rowdy in youth club. And sometimes, on the odd occasion, the teenage lads were itching for a bit of trouble. At those points, I would bravely or foolishly say, depending on your point of view, well, if there's trouble, there's only going to be one winner, and it's not going to be you. I would try and say in my scary Scottish accent. Seeing some of the lads now, I'm glad they never started any trouble, because some of them are big. And as a Christian, as God's people, we approach and can approach persecution and trouble not foolishly or bravely, like I try to do, but confidently. If, like the little horn in Daniel, someone goes up against God, there's only going to be one winner, and it's not going to be them. Verse 25 says this about the persecutor, yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. The encouragement we have from Daniel 8, the Old Testament, the history of the church, is that God remains in control. And those who try to destroy God's people will themselves ultimately be destroyed. Let's skip forward to the last book of the Bible, Revelation chapter 5. John writes this. Then one of the elders said to me, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. Then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne. And it continues, and they sang a new song, saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. The lion morphs into the lamb, and we see a portrait of the crucified and risen Lord Jesus. In Daniel and Revelation, in stories of rams and goats and persecution, we're to be encouraged that ultimately the government of the universe is in God's hands and in the hands of the one who died and rose again for our salvation. That's the one that's got the power. The God of Daniel's still on the throne. The God of Brian and Steve and Gordon and anyone else who trusts in Christ, that God's still on the throne. And that God will defeat all evil and deliver his people forever. That's the kingdom to come. And that's what we have to take away from Daniel 8 this morning. We have 5 minutes, so I'm going to try something with you. Normally I give you questions and say, sit quietly for 2 minutes and reflect on the questions, and you'll start thinking about roast chicken and stuff like that. So I've put the questions up. I know, I've been there. So we're going to put the questions up, but I'd just like you to maybe, if it's not too awkward, chat to someone near you. What stood out from today's talk? I'm not going to get involved in a discussion group because it's bad for a speaker's ego when people can't remember what you spoke about. What stood out from today's talk? What type of persecution do you most fear today? One of our bits of church vision is being open-hearted with each other. This is the chance to do it. And then maybe not yet, maybe one day, are you able to share a situation when Christ ultimately defeated persecution in your life? Have a think about that. It's that kind of being thankful thing, isn't it? We sometimes worry, where's Christ in it? And then we look back and say, oh, that's exactly where he was, right when I needed him. So have a little confab. I'll give you a few moments. If there's 2 minutes of awkward silence, I'll step in early. And then we'll finish the service. But the questions are on the screen. Thank you.